Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, I got to hear how Dublin Bus, Éireann Rod Éireann and An Garda Síochána are embracing wellness within their organisations. Cardiologist Dr. Robert Kelly on matters of the heart, and presenter and writer Maya Dunphy on the gut-brain connection she made in her teens. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I've had a great week. I'm feeling good and content of late. Sing when you're winning, as they say. I think one of the best things about getting older is that you become more and more comfortable in your own skin. You realise how precious life is and you're not going to waste it worrying about what other people think. So everything I'm doing lately feels good. I feel aligned and in my own power. So it's a good place to be. Long may it last. And I had a great full circle moment of my own last week when I hosted an event in my hometown of Howth in Dublin. I teamed up with Elaine Nick Raymond of the hiking club Shulin and her sister Neve, who led our yoga, and I got to put my level 2 breathwork teacher training into action. So the 30 people who came were spread out on their mats with their blankets and their pillows on what was once the floor of the nightclub in my local town, where many years of fun was had. It closed down a good few years back, but it was such a central hub in my late teens and my early 20s. So many good memories are within those walls, and it was only a walk home. I've actually thought many times recently, I wish there was something like that on our doorstep for when the time comes with my own kids. I mean, there was obviously a bit of messing at the time, but it was all very safe and community-based. And, you know, as I say, we were only a walk away. So if my younger self could have seen my current self leading breathwork there, I'm not sure she would have believed it. We didn't talk about health and wellness back then, just diet and exercise. So many, many things have changed. And I do want to give the venue a plug, because if you're a Northside dub, you might have frequented Zenith's or then K2 nightclub before it closed and appreciate the memory jog. But the pub, the Summit Inn, is still going strong, and the space at the back has been fully renovated for events, parties and even breathwork and yoga sessions. They have done a great job and the staff were so good to us. I would definitely recommend it. And it was really lovely to be back within those walls. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, the PG Cert in Workplace Wellness is a part-time postgraduate qualification designed for professionals who want to lead and manage workplace wellbeing initiatives effectively. It's delivered by Portal at Trinity College Dublin, and the course provides students with the knowledge, skills and practical tools to create healthier, more productive workplaces. For the final module, organisations are invited to submit a real workplace wellbeing challenge they are facing for the student teams to work on. And I went along to the college to hear the final presentation pitches and meet some of the students and organisations. I started by talking with course co-founder Brian Crook of Workplace Wellbeing Ireland to set the scene for the day.
Workwellireland.ie is my organisation. And I have the great privilege of being course director for the postgrad in workplace wellness at Portal in Trinity College in Dublin.
And what's happening here today?
So today is the culmination of the entire postgrad. We have our final module host project presentations. So the whole program is very, very practical. And that culminates today with the students who've been working with host organizations on real-world challenges that they've been facing over the course of the last couple of months. So, for example, we have An Garda Síochána represented, we have Circle K, we have Platform 55, we have the ESB, we have Just Eat. We have a very broad mix of organisations. They've tasked the students with specific workplace wellbeing challenges that they've been facing. And so the student teams, you know, multidisciplinary teams have been working on those. And today, they're going to present back their findings, their research, and their recommendations to the host organizations. Hard to believe, and we have over 90 students this year, Claire, which just kind of shows you the growing interest in this space.
What sort of impact do you think these graduates are having?
Well, so what we're trying to do here is to create the chief wellbeing officer role. We want to embed that in organizations. We want to see that created in more and more organizations. Currently, very well-intentioned organizations are implementing a series of random acts of wellness, is how I would describe it. What we're trying to do here is create strategic frameworks to embed cultures of health across organizations. So embed it into the fabric of the organization, to bake it in as opposed to bolt it on. So that's what we're creating here and supporting here. And these students, these mature students, are going back into their workplaces to try and influence that, try and influence that change.
What about the organizations you have on board? As you said, there's a real wide range. Has that changed over the 5 years, the willingness for companies and organizations to get involved and embrace workplace wellbeing?
I certainly believe so, yeah. One, in terms of the organizations, more and more organizations of all sizes and of all industries are interested in this. But also, I would say, when we started back in 2019, interestingly, the demographic was most of our students were coming from a HR background, and we still get many HR professionals taking the program. But today, of over the 90 students, I mean, we have a brilliant mix of HR, health and safety, people from finance backgrounds, from facilities backgrounds as well, people working in the charity sector. It's a really, really broad mix of backgrounds. Your background doesn't really matter. It's, are you within an organization and are you passionate enough? Can you feel like you can influence change? Can you make change happen in your organization?
And just for the time of year that it is and the occasion that it is, can you remind people of the concept of workplace wellbeing?
Well, workplace wellbeing is anything. It could be anything from an initiative, an intervention, right the way through to a policy. But ultimately, it comes down to modeling healthy behaviors. Leading by example. Are the leaders in the organization modeling healthy behaviors by being physically active? Yes, but by maintaining boundaries, work-life balance, work-home boundaries. They're not sending emails at all hours of the night. Maybe they're communicating with their team, they're sharing meals with others, they're allowing time for that, they're taking their annual leave. Something as simple as that. And is that then being reflected across the wider workforce? That's a real culture of health.
So I'm going to hear some of the presentations this afternoon and meet some of the students. How are things backstage?
Things backstage, they're a little bit of nervousness there, a lot of excitement as well. So they've had their practice runs this morning. There's a really incredible amount of work has gone on in just in a short amount of time. So I think you're going to be impressed with the presentations. I think the organizations are going to be incredibly impressed with the presentations and the recommendations that these students are suggesting. Yeah, so really exciting.
Brilliant. Let's get going. I then got to meet some of the organisations who had set the students a real workplace wellbeing challenge.
Hi, my name's Vivian Horkin and I'm the head of health and wellbeing in Agarda Síochána.
And Stephen?
My name is Stephen Dalton and I am the Wellbeing Training and Development Officer in Garda Síochána.
And I think people might be surprised at those two sentences alone, that there is a head of health and wellness in Garda Síochána.
And Garda Síochána has a health and wellbeing strategy, and as part of that, the health and wellbeing office was established in October 2022.
Mm. And even though I said people would be surprised perhaps that there's a health and wellness wing in An Garda Síochána, but it's a highly stressed job. That's certainly where you'd want to have one.
Yeah, which is why we want to get accessibility. We want everyone to be informed. We want them to feel supported. We want them engaged and empowered too. So that's the part of this today, was to develop communication strategy that is not just about communications, it's about connection and creating unity. So it's to create those psychological safe spaces, you know, that people come together and to spread out that positive ripple.
What were some of the things you discovered from the survey when you surveyed the organisation?
Yeah, well, there was an initial survey in 2019, so that informed our strategy up to 2025. So the main themes are around, you know, mental health supports and addressing stigma within the organisation, and the communication piece, as Stephen has alluded to as well. So there's a couple of different themes that have come out of that survey, and now we have a second survey. We just don't have the results of that just yet.
So have you felt a difference within the culture over the 5 years?
It's the conversations are more open, which is what we were aiming for, you know, to have those, to say that psychological safe spaces where people can be honest, because people want transparency in their health and well-being. You know, we're building the trust again, and that people can see the consistency and the sustainability of health and well-being in an Garda Síochána. So we can see that change, that cultural, it's the people, the change in conversations.
And what was the real world problem that you set the students today that we're going to hear the presentation on?
It is about how do we communicate everything that's happening in relation to health and well-being to support 18,000 Garda personnel. How do we get that so that everybody knows exactly what's happening and what supports are there for them?
So I'm Ciara McKeown and I'm the Health Promotion Executive with Dublin Bus.
So you have just seen the students give their presentation about minding the workers. You set them a fairly tough challenge.
Absolutely. When I saw them presenting, I was a bit shocked at how hard of brief I gave them. They really discussed all around how to... We have a really strong health and safety culture in Dublin Bus, and we want to now embed health and well-being like health and safety is embedded. So it was around that and incorporating psychosocial risks and psychosocial health. So it was so interesting that then they did such a good job on it.
And then some of the students, fresh from their pitch presentations.
My name is Karen Davis and I worked on the Éireann Road Éireann project.
And what was the challenge that you and the team were set?
So our challenge was to look at putting forward a business case for introducing a mental health first aid programme into Éireann Road Éireann.
And some of the challenges you had were the diversity in the workforce. There's some people who are driving trains, there's some people in office, there's some people working shift work. How did you navigate that?
So we did a couple of things. So we would have got material from Éireann Road Éireann. So we would have gotten their wellbeing strategy. We would have gotten some information to their HR processes. But it was the primary research, really. So what we did was we carried out about 12 interviews with individuals, and it was a broad range of people. So from train drivers to people in the offices and like across the spectrum, really, to understand from their perspectives the challenges that they felt were happening within the organisation.
And for those that don't know, can you explain the concept of a mental health first aider?
I suppose within wellbeing, the terminology now is that you would have mental health first aiders. What they really are mental health champions. So the word can be used interchangeably, but really what a mental health first aider is, it's somebody there that if somebody on site, wouldn't just matter whether you're office based or site based, but they can be directed to that individual, and that individual can hear the concerns, listen to what issues they may be having, and be able to signpost them to the right supports. And sometimes that may be within the company, but sometimes it may be externally outside the company. So they're really there to support them overall and point them in the right direction.
My name is Patrick and I was working on a project for Platform 55 in order to help them with their clients connect the dots around well-being. Well-being isn't just this nice thing to have, that it has this core business component to it in terms of financial gains, as well as also a lot of legal obligations, and more of which are coming down the line.
Can you touch on one of those? Because I think it'd be interesting for people to hear that.
So I suppose from the financial part, there was a really interesting paper that was published last summer. And as part of it, what they did was they used companies who were performing in kind of the top 100 companies for well-being. They used them as almost like a stock portfolio that they tracked them over a number of years and kind of pseudo-invested $1,000 in them, and then compared them over a number of years against kind of traditional stock market portfolios. And it clearly showed that they outperformed normal stock portfolios, which just goes to show, you know, the stock markets don't lie. If you are investing in well-being, you are, as a firm, going to perform better.
Yeah, and I mean, that shouldn't be the reason people do it, but it does help for the investment in well-being.
Exactly. And, you know, I think we always need to have a holistic approach. But the challenge, and I think even, you know, when we look at the world at the moment and some of the challenges with DEI programs getting pulled in other jurisdictions, is that if there isn't also that financial safeguard with this, it runs the risk of being cut. And again, I don't want to sound like we should just be doing this for the money, because I also strongly believe that we need to be looking after our workforce. But it's that it's also showing that by doing this, you are getting the added benefit too of this is cost effective.
It really was such an interesting day. I got to learn a lot. For more information, you can go to workwellireland.ie.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, my next guest, cardiologist Dr. Robert Kelly, has taken people on many health journeys through his work, but it was perhaps his own health journey which had the most surprising impact. Looking at lifestyle and preventative medicine, Robert designed a plan to help all his patients embrace small steps towards a longer and healthier life. And Dr. Robert Kelly joins me in studio now. Robert, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire.
We are friends. We shared the TEDx Tralee stage together. You invited me to your book launch also to interview you. So it's nice now to interview you here on my show. This is our trio. I watched your TEDx talk back again. You're killing it in the views. I was almost begrudgingly giving you another view. But it really resonates with people because people think heart health, avoiding stroke, heart disease, it's just a really big thing that looms in the corner, whereas you've really tried to break it down and make it more accessible for people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm delighted my TEDx talk has done so well, and quite surprisingly. And I reached out to everybody at work who was from all over the world and said, please like my TEDx talk, please like my TEDx talk. But a lot of feedback has come back to me saying, even from patients, to say, I listened to your TEDx talk, Dr. Kelly. It's great. The small steps, they're great. I'm able to do them and I'm starting to do them now, which was the only thing I actually wanted my TEDx talk to achieve.
Because you were meeting patients who might need like a stent put in or who have had a heart attack, and you're giving them the advice, but you were finding that it wasn't resonating with them.
So the truth was that I was practicing in cardiology for, I was about 10 years back here in my job, and patients were coming back after the stents in particular that I had put in, and either they still had symptoms or they wanted more medication because the cholesterol wasn't coming down, or they weren't really picking up the fact that you really had to deal with the root cause of the problem, which was all the lifestyle factors. And I worked out that in some patients where I'd done a procedure and I had to do a procedure again, I found that some of the disease got worse. And I was kind of going, well, you've had the stent, you've had the medication, what's going on here? And so I'd find a number of patients breaking rules. I mean, really dramatic changes or bad habits, like a passion for certain ice cream bars, a passion for other foods that you wouldn't want to give up in the eyes of the patient, the smoker's not stopping smoking, and all those different lifestyle pillars that, in fairness, I probably didn't address with the patients in those days. And I certainly know my colleagues didn't address it based on the fact that we're all so busy and the patients don't get a lot of time. And invariably, we tell patients what to do. We're not so good at listening to patients, which was really where I had my big breakthrough in changing the way I do things.
Because that is the health system we have at the minute. It's crisis. We wait until something goes wrong before we seek help. And then the medical professionals patch you up and send you back out into the same world. Now, obviously, you've evolved since then. But before we get into that evolution, something I really want to ask you, and this is a bit rogue, is about the work you do and dealing with somebody's heart and being responsible for putting in stents. How do you manage to keep your cool when you're doing something like that?
So I've done two of those this morning before I got here. So you get trained for these things. I think it's like an airline pilot. You know your job. You know how to fly a plane. You know how to put stents in. You work with a team of people who are very supportive. So if something goes wrong, if you have the right team of people there, they're there to help you. Everybody knows what to do. The risks of something bad, like a heart attack during an angiogram or a stent, is very, very low. So the vast majority of patients get through the procedure without any major hiccup. And when it's more difficult, you tend to, if you've been doing this for some time, which I have, you tend to allow your experience to come through and deal with that. So, I mean, it's very rewarding. I mean, I went into cardiology because I wanted to do something very quick that I could potentially save a life and that the patients would do much better. But the lifestyle medicine journey made me realize that it's not as quick as that or as quick a fix as that. But I really thoroughly enjoy having the skill and the ability to do the stent work with patients.
And the things you were mentioning there, the smoking, the ice cream bars, when people think about lifestyle change or lifestyle medicine, do you think the mindset is wrong that people think it's either living a fun life or living a life that's not fun? And they think, OK, I don't really want to have a stroke or a heart attack, but I'd much sooner go out, having the crack, and you have to kind of realign their thoughts that, you know, you can still have the odd ice cream bar, you're still going to be enjoying your life and you'll be healthier for it.
Absolutely. So I'm very much one of moderation, and I firmly believe in the 80-20 rule, that 80% of the time, if you can make an improvement in what you do, you can fall out on the 20%. When you're away on holidays, you can enjoy yourself and eat a little bit more. But the other 80% of the time, you need to make the changes. And so I also, one of my colleagues at work suggested to me that she loves the idea of the saint and the sinner. You know, that you can be a saint a lot of the time, but everybody's also a sinner too. You're not going to be perfect. And truthfully, if you try to be perfect, you'll develop a mental health problem and you'll develop the stress pillar in your life. And the stress pillar will give you more problems than the eating pillar will give you. So I think I try to help patients make small changes for very purposeful reasons, that if I ask them to do everything, nothing changes. So, you know, if I can get you to stop the ice cream bar, or if I can get you to stop smoking, or if I can get you even to take your tablets, that's much more progress. And patients do very well because they like to be engaged in plans like that that help them get better.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a friend of mine who, one of the lifestyle habits that she changed was that when she went in to pay for the petrol, she didn't pick up something there. And that was the only change. And often we think you need to clear out the whole treat cupboard out of the house, that there can never be sugar there ever again. But that's too much. But that really small change, I mean, do we get petrol once a week, twice a month? That all builds over time, over a year, over years, and makes a big difference. I also think people underestimate, and I know because I've been on this journey myself, for years I was stuck in restriction and really dieting all of the time. And that was my sole focus. But when I started to really eat properly, I had more energy. I was sleeping better. I had more energy to do the exercise. So I think when people are eating a lot of processed foods or takeaways or smoking, and I say this without finger wagging, they don't realise they could feel better than they do now, and it would motivate them to stay on track a little bit more.
So I totally agree with you. So I believe that you shouldn't be dieting, that you should be making healthy changes to the foods you actually eat. So examples would be trying to get more fruit into your diet. You know, add a piece of fruit for breakfast, add a piece of fruit for lunch. Trying to get the five vegetables, that a lot of people don't eat any vegetables at all. Trying to make healthier changes, drinking more water instead of going for the cup of coffee as an example, or trying to make those changes over a period of time, you will lose weight because you're coming from a baseline largely where you're eating unhealthy food. As you rightfully say, where you've less sugar, you've less ultra-processed food, even less alcohol in your diet, you'll feel much more energetic. And when you sleep much better, because that's what'll happen, you won't feel as stressful the next day when you get up. You'll be very much on top of everything that you're planning to do. And so it is as simple as that. And yet people really, really struggle to do it.
What's the kind of feedback you've had from patients and people that have done your online courses?
So there are two groups. So I've coached a lot of the staff in the hospital, largely nurses and senior managers, and the impact there is quite incredible. And what was most surprising is they found they enjoyed their job much more. They were much more engaged because they engaged with their health. And this was just kind of totally, we weren't looking for that, but also much more engaged in all the pillars. Patients as well. Patients love small steps. They love little things that they can go back to doing and saying, Dr. Kelly, I might have slipped over Christmas week, but you know when I'm back again, I'm drinking the water every day. I'm getting out and taking a walk every day. And, you know, the thing that's important is that we're all very different here. So I'm not trying to get people out running the marathon. If you put on your shoes and go outside the door for 2 minutes, even today, tomorrow, and the next day, and up at the days after, the feedback has been really, really positive. Everybody feels much more engaged with, which is what patients really, really value. And patients tend to do things in that frame of mind. Whereas I think that the patients that don't do so well are not engaged enough in actually wanting to change their behaviour.
So is it true, we often hear that the heart attack you have in your 50s or 60s started in your 20s and 30s. Is that true?
Absolutely true. So there's a slide that I show with a lot of presentations, which is the onset of plaque in your arteries can actually start in your teens. So a lot of people who might have a heart attack in their 50s may have actually started the process 10 or 20 years before that. The reality is a lot of patients I see in their 50s tend to be like that. So it is decades of unhealthy behaviour.
And we're so weight focused So can you be carrying no weight and still have an unhealthy heart?
Absolutely. Just like you can be supremely fit and still have an unhealthy heart.
And how do you know?
You don't know. And this is why my biggest mantra in the whole of what I do is to encourage people to get checked out. I mean, you don't know till you go and get checked out. So I strongly encourage people to have a cardiac CT scan to see do you have plaque in your arteries. Or I strongly encourage you to go and see the doctor and have the cholesterol and the blood pressure and the blood sugar checked. They're the factors that determine if you get the plaque that we talk about in your 50s. And everybody should do that over 40. There is no reason why you shouldn't do that, because you should be engaged in prioritizing your health. The problem is we don't do that. We prioritize everything else in life and health seems to fall to the bottom.
So are we keeping an eye on our blood pressure?
Mm-hmm.
And what about, I mean, look, everyone's going to be out of breath walking upstairs. It is exertion, but what's the measure? How quickly you get your breath back after that?
So the measure in terms of exercise is largely that you try and walk at a moderate pace for the health purpose. So a moderate pace, we say that if you pass the talk test, which is you walk to a level of pace that you're just about able to talk to the person beside you. For those of you who do regular exercise, we bring that up to what's called a singing test. So you're just about able to sing a few notes to the person beside you. That's considered vigorous exercise. Ultimately, if you want the best benefit, moderate. Some people, you might get that on one flight of stairs. But you could kind of build that up over a period of time and do two flights of stairs and three flights of stairs, very similar to other behaviours. And particularly the opportunity for that is when you're at work.
But if you get to the top of the stairs and you're really out of breath and it takes you a long time to get your breath back, is that an indication there could be something going on?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're not feeling right, you should go and see a doctor and get checked out. That's the ultimate starting place, is there. Because you don't know if you have a high cholesterol. Most people don't know if you have high blood pressure. And as we said, you can develop a heart problem much earlier in your life. You have no idea if you have it. And one of the most dramatic things that happens in cardiology is meeting people who lose their husbands or their wives or siblings to sudden death in their 50s because they block an artery. Everybody has somebody they know in that particular situation. Most of those patients, the first symptom they ever had is they drop dead. So that's what you want to prevent.
And you know this because this happened with your own brother.
So sadly, I do know this. My younger brother died he was 21 when he was in his second last year of medical school and I was the year ahead of him. And I found my brother dead at home, knowing that he'd been up that morning where his heart had just stopped. Now, it wasn't due to a blocked artery, because at that age, it's due to something different. I shared that story. I've shared it in a book I've written. I've shared it in practice with other patients because I have a certain perspective that I can see where patients come from as much as where I come from. But again, that may drive my purpose a lot. I say in places that it does, because I want people to have an opportunity to live a long and healthy life. There's no reason why it shouldn't happen if you look after yourself, if you go and get checked out.
There are some things that are unavoidable, perhaps, but you're talking about the avoidable because, you know, there are small little steps we can take that can make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
So what about young people then? Because as a parent, I do sometimes worry. We hear a lot about sudden death and the energy drinks and the sports field. And do we need to be worrying about our teenagers' hearts?
So in most circumstances, what we suggest is if you have a family history of somebody dying young. So, for example, I've had my heart checked out and so have my siblings had their heart checked out in the context of our brother dying. I think if you have a situation where there is a family history, say your mom or your dad or your cousin or things like that, have dropped dead at a young age. So under 30 is the cutoff. Most people over 30 start developing plaque in the arteries as the cause of death. So that is one situation. So there's a family history. The other situation is if you have symptoms such as the chest pains, the shortness of breath and other symptoms that are disproportionate to your level of general health. And sometimes your mother will notice that, or sometimes you're playing sports and your coach might notice that. The other example is you might get palpitations, short of breath or chest pain, which traditionally when it comes to sport will be as you exercise as opposed to at rest. The big red flag is if you black out as you exercise. That's a very concerning symptom. And then the other situation, again, as you mentioned, is if you're taking a lot of things like energy drinks, drinks with lots of sugar, or if you're drinking alcohol or if you're doing other things, These may all increase your heart rate. And so you may start feeling your heart racing very, very fast. So it's just, there's a lot of things that are bad for your health, particularly when you're trying to do concerns around your heart health. And I know there's a lot of programs out there that go into schools and screen kids and do a recording of the heartbeat, which is called an ECG. And that has a very low pickup in truth in the vast majority of kids. But I think where you have the family history and you have the symptoms, they're the kids who in particular need to be looked at. One other concern is if you have a family history of somebody drowning on their own, or somebody perhaps who's crashed a car again on their own, or somebody who potentially has had a seizure without any obvious provoking factor, that can sometimes be a red flag that that was a cardiac event. And that of itself might lead to a suggestion that your child should go and see the doctor and be assessed.
Not that I've ever underestimated you before, Robert, but I'm very conscious that all of the information you're giving is potentially life-saving. So I think it's worth saying also that when it comes to a heart attack, men and women present differently with their symptoms, don't they? And I think that's an important one, because women often get misdiagnosed when they present to A&E with what can be considered anxiety, but is actually, in fact, a heart attack.
So the challenge with women is, there's a few. So you may get symptoms of pain in your tummy. It may be on your right shoulder. It may be in your neck. It might be breathless. Whereas men typically having a heart attack get chest pain in the center. It's like a weight on the chest. It goes up the neck or down the arm. You tend to feel very sweaty. You tend to feel quite sick. A lot of women don't necessarily get those symptoms. So I say to women as patients, if you're not feeling right, go into the hospital or call the ambulance or go and see the doctor. Get checked out. And if you're not happy that you're getting a response that you think is the right one, persist. Because, you know, sometimes you see a doctor who may not have the same experience. They don't think there's anything wrong with you and you feel that something's not right. So I strongly encourage women to persist in that situation. You know, if something's not right, you do have to act a little bit on your own instinct and your own intuition. Women are not well represented when you go to cardiology clinical trials. There's a very small percent, sometimes 10 or 20%. So the truth is we don't know everything about women. But having done a lot of the tests, they're just as predictive. Women, particularly over 50, as they got a lot of abnormal tests, which might be inconvenient, but they do pick up things. And so if you have things like the cardiac CT done, it picks up plaque in your arteries. You get to see whether you have a problem or not. But I have found I've been asked actually to do more work in relation to women as a man, as a male cardiologist, to try and engage in this a little bit more, because I think it's very interesting. Because again, as I said, I'm trying to pick up the problem so I can help people. So I do think the one other comment I'd make to women out there is if you have had breast cancer, women get very focused on cancer as a cause of death. And unfortunately, heart disease is a much higher cause of death. And so, for example, if you have surgery on your left breast in particular, and you start feeling pain beyond that behind, don't discount the fact that you think it's all surgically related or it's breast cancer related, because sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's actually your heart that's the problem. So it's just really important for you to remember that, that it's not all one thing, and not to overlook something that could be even more serious.
Yeah, and advocate for yourself and go with that gut feeling you know when something isn't right. For the sake of balance, what are the symptoms for men when it comes to heart attack?
So as I was saying, the men tend to get a typical weight on a chest. It tends to give a sensation up the neck or down the left arm. And men tend to break out in a very significant sweat and may get sick. Men don't tend to have the other varied symptoms. So a bit like I said that women are underrepresented in clinical trials, all the textbooks in cardiology and all the textbooks in men give the story about the man's chest pain symptoms.
And you have a book, The Heart Book, written in your garden during COVID, named by your wife for, as we're discussing, matters of the heart. How has that felt for that to be out in the world?
So I think there are a couple of things about the book. I really wanted to write a book because there's so much information, as you can see, to try and share with patients. Mm. The time isn't there in the consultation. The TEDx talk is 15 minutes long. So it's really kind of a reference for patients and for anybody who wants to read about heart health. The message is totally about empowering you to do something, but it teaches you the small steps and it gives everybody a practical way to take on one pillar at a time. And as I said about the women's health, I've recently been asked by an American publisher, would I write another book focusing on the emotional health for women when it comes to heart disease? So
watch this space.
The book has led to great growth in so many areas.
Amazing. Well, it's clear that you obviously have a wealth of knowledge and expertise behind you, but you're very much heart-led in your work, if you don't mind me saying. If people want to find out more, they can go to drrobertkelly.ie, and the book is called The Heart Book. Robert Kelly, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, April is IBS Awareness Month, and poor gut health is undermining the health, well-being and self-confidence of a huge number of Irish people. A recent study of more than 1,000 adults in Ireland shows the majority of people, 85%, believe gut health issues significantly impact their quality of life. One in five people in Ireland are thought to be affected by IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and many go undiagnosed for most of their lives and suffer in silence. TV personality, writer and producer Maya Dunphy was diagnosed in the 90s with IBS when she was 16 years old, and she joins me in studio now. Well, Maya, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire. Let's talk bowels. Some women get makeup, shampoo to talk about beauty things. I get bowels and I'm more than happy to do it.
Because I've been trying to get you on the show for a while, and who knew it was your bowels that were going to make it happen?
It was the guts that got you.
But we don't have any taboos on this show. When it comes to your health, we should talk about everything and not be uncomfortable about it.
Now we talk about, I remember, and it's a source of great disappointment to me, 9 years ago I pitched a documentary idea to a broadcaster about the menopause, and they went, oh, it's a bit too niche. And I said, well, it's half the population unless they die young, which is not niche. And they turned it down, and fast forward a year, and then Mariella Frostrup did her one, and then it all took off. And I'm so glad it took off, but I would like to have been, you know, one of the first to do it. And I think now we talk about female health a lot more, but I think the issue around our bowel health is still something that people are, especially women, aren't too comfortable chatting about. Like once you've had a baby, you will talk to your other mum friends about it a bit more. But I do think it's possibly one of the last taboos.
You'll have to get back in with another pitch about bowels.
I made a documentary about food about 12 years ago, and we went through the Bristol stool chart, which is, do you know the Bristol stool chart?
Yes, sure, it's so interesting. It. Explain it to people.
It's a list of what a healthy stool, i.e. poo, looks like. Now, obviously, I think we all know what an unhealthy poo can look like, but some people don't actually know what a healthy stool looks like.
Or what an indicator that is,
yeah, exactly,
for
that.
Your health or how you're taking exactly. in your nutrition. Yeah. So rather than just yeah. flushing and walking away, it's good to have a look and yeah. see how are things going. And again, I don't think people like to talk about that.
I'm a continent. And sometimes people say, oh, there's a very strange toilet in the hotel I'm in. And it's got a sort of like almost like a shelf. So often like the poo kind of just sort of slides down slowly. And I said, that's a viewing platform. They have these kind of, ours are just kind of straight drops down. And some of the continental ones have just a slight, not quite a shelf, but a less severe incline so that you can actually have a look. Look at Claire's. I actually don't mind talking about this. And when I was 16, I was, it's terrible. I don't know, I think I'm a bit older than you, but I was 16 in the 90s, and it was a time when, I hate to say this now, but I was the same weight I am now since I was 16, but I was always trying to be healthy and be on a diet. That was the era where there was one look and it was basically Kate Moss. And I remember I was always living on apples. And my stomach was always like a basketball. It was so hard. And it was the apples. I was having too much acid. Now, I just want to say, for most people, apples might not be a problem. But I went to my GP, lovely family GP, and she said, like, once we rule out other conditions, she said, then what we deem you to have is IBS. There's no one, you can't do a test for IBS, and it affects people in very different ways. But I said to her, well, what is it and how do I get rid of it? Because that's what I want to know, how do I get rid of it? She said, in my limited experience, because she hadn't come across many cases, she said, look, it's a fairly new term. And she, in my limited experience, she said, like, you can't get rid of it. You have to learn to live with it. You'll have to learn what your triggers are. They'll be different for everyone. But she said, but from what I know of it now, she said, I've never met somebody who I've told has it who's not also a worrier, which is interesting.
And would you have been that kind of kid? Because I think that GP was way ahead of her time to be making that gut-brain connection.
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Hannon. She's in her 90s now. not practicing anymore, but she was one of those brilliant family GPs who did everything. Like, she'd deliver your baby and then look after your gut health 20 years later. She was just brilliant.
And look at health in a holistic way. So not just what you're eating, but how you were thinking and feeling and what impact that was having on your gut health.
And I was like, oh God, why would worry? And I was a very anxious teen, and I'm less anxious now, but certainly, you know, I would be a worrier. And everyone that I have said, and I actually did a campaign with Alpharex 7 years ago, which is a supplement that I take now. And I met women who suffered with IBS, and the symptoms were very different for all of us. Mine was mainly very severe pain, and it would come, unfortunately, like white wine. I know, everyone looks sorry. Oh, the head tilt. Things like white wine, some fruits, things like dried fruit, sulfites. So you have to kind of learn what triggers it for you. And I would.
What are sulfites?
Sulfites are, they can occur naturally, but they tend to be added to food as well. So they're in a lot of wine. Funnily enough, there's less of them in champagne. And things like dried fruits, I think they occur naturally in dried fruit, but they're added to a lot of things too. Coffee's quite high in sulfites. So for me, I would get, I could feel it starting. It was like someone was twisting my gut, and it would be so bad. And then my face would start to feel really hot, and I would have to just leave wherever I was and go home because it was that painful. And it would take half an hour to pass, and it wasn't like trapped wind or things like that. It was just very, very bad cramps. And I would get those a couple of times a month sometimes, and they were very debilitating. And so I started to try and work out what the triggers were for me. But even some days when I was really careful, I'd feel it starting to happen. I'd go, oh my God, I'd be at a work event. And maybe then it was just the stress. I don't know. Maybe it was that.
So what would you do in a situation like that? You're presenting the VIP Style Awards, your gut starts twisting. Do you just have to carry on, or leg it?
That didn't happen. They went from being once or twice a month to once or twice a year. And I know it was definitely a supplement because I was in London for a month and I couldn't get hold of it. So I was like, oh, it'll be fine. Didn't take it. And after 3 weeks, I had one of those attacks. So I actually haven't had them severely for the last 7 years. So before that, I wasn't doing things. Well, the VIP Style Awards would make anyone's gut twist. I did that 2 years in a row. It was absolutely terrifying. But there were times when I would be, say, I remember being at a pre-wedding event for my friend, and I stupidly grabbed a glass off the tray, and it was Prosecco, which I know doesn't really suit me. Started drinking it. Half an hour later, I started to feel the pain. And all you can do is leave, because it really is, the pain was that severe that you can't really, you know, breathe your way through it. And I left, and I came back a few hours later, but then it was sort of too late to join the party.
And it's a funny thing, isn't it? You kind of alluded to a couple of things we do when it comes to our own health and well-being. We forget, we think, ah, it's grand. So even though you go through years of debilitating pain, you find a supplement that works, you start taking it, you're like, I don't need this anymore, I'm fixed. It's funny. Or you pick up the glass of Prosecco and think, ah, it'll be grand. Yeah. Why do we do that? I think it might be a self-defense mechanism that we don't want to be conscious of the pain all the time.
It's free Prosecco on a tray. It doesn't matter how old I get, I will always reach for the glass of free stuff on a tray. No, that I'm being facetious. Well, I think sometimes, and I have friends who are intolerant to certain foods and will be out somewhere, and the food that I know makes them feel unwell is on a shared platter, and they'll go, ah, sod, it doesn't matter. I think sometimes it's you don't want to miss out, you don't want to be difficult, you don't want to seem like you're the person who's not joining in. Now, obviously, if you have an allergy, you simply can't touch these things. But if you think, oh, yeah, I'll feel a bit crap in them, I think it's probably some of us sometimes, you know, we might pig out in junk food, we might drink a bit too much, or you let things slide sometimes, and you know you'll suffer the next day. I think as women, as we get older, certainly for me, the things that I used to do that make me not feel great, I just do less of now, because it's just, when you're a mother as well, it's just not really worth it, unfortunately.
How do you manage your stress? Because I know you're busy. I know you're a single mom. Are you self-employed?
Yeah.
Freelancer? Yeah. I mean, all these things are stressful. How do you manage yours?
I just take the free Prosecco off the tray. No, I don't. Do you know what? It's I'd love to say I have some miracle, but I don't. It takes time. It's taken me like 4 decades to learn to choose my battles. I think, you know, you decide what's important right now and what isn't. I've also learned to take a step back when you start to feel kind of worry build and go, okay, what do I know to be true right now? Because sometimes, like, my mind can just wander off on tangents and you're worrying about things that haven't happened yet, that might not even happen. I go, okay, right now, what do I have to do? Right now, I have to get the dinner. I have to get uniform ready for the morning. I have this email to send. This can wait till tomorrow. And I'm very good at doing that now, more than I ever was before, which I think is really important, because I think you can let things snowball in your head and suddenly you realise your chest is feeling tight, but you're worrying about things that haven't happened yet and might not happen at all.
So what would you say to someone listening who's really identified with some of the things you said around IBS, who said, you know, I didn't really think about that, but now that you mention it, there's been a couple of things I've had to leave because I'm in pain.
Yeah.
We kind of just say, this is just who I am.
Yeah.
Would you advise them to stay there or to seek help?
Absolutely not. Don't suffer in silence. And the thing about IBS, like I said, it's not just things like most people will have gas, bloating, mild to moderate pain. But then some people will kind of go between severe diarrhea and then severe constipation, which are both awful to have to live with as well. And I mean, I think you said at the top, 1 in 5 people in Ireland are thought maybe to have IBS, but it's more women than men. So don't suffer in silence. Go and talk to your GP, and certainly don't be embarrassed by it. And also, there are other conditions. It might not be IBS. There are conditions, things like Crohn's, celiac disease, that might have to be ruled out as well. But talk to your GP, and then do try. I mean, there are a lot of probiotics out there. Try something like that. Do give it a month or two for your body to get used to it. But mostly, don't be embarrassed and don't suffer in silence.
Yeah. And I think we've proved that it is possible to have a conversation and stay smiling. There's exactly. No taboo around your bodily functions.
I bought a picture of healthy stools. Do you want to see it? No, I won't.
I have a video actually on my grid of me in my bathroom. Now, I am fully dressed with the toilet seat down. I thought it would be a bit of a step too far, but I did speak about the Bristol stool chart because I think it's worth Googling.
It's
worth Googling, and it's worth just being aware. It's a bodily function like any others, and we shouldn't be embarrassed.
What is the optimum poo?
Yeah. So keep an eye. Maya, thank you for continuing to break taboos. I look forward to seeing your documentary on poo coming soon. But it's lovely to see you, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to see what Maya is up to, you can go to her Instagram at Maya Dunphy. Maya, thanks again. So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.